Hello and welcome to another SPAC Insider podcast, where we bring an independent eye in interviewing the targets of SPAC transactions and their SPAC partners. Developing new medical treatments takes time and money, which is generally where SPACs come in. But ABPRO has managed to resolve many of those questions before SPAC investors will join the show. I'm Nick Layton, and this week I speak with ABPRO Chairman and CEO Ian Chan and Shahrab Ahmad, Chairman and CEO of Atlantic Coastal Acquisition Corp. II. The two announced a $500 million combination in January. Shahrab explains how ABPRO came onto Atlantic Coastal II's radar after the SPAC had originally been fishing in the mobility space, and why the particularities of its capital needs could be a fit for the current market conditions. Ian walks through ABPRO's clinical path moving forward, and how it can use a mix of its internal discovery engines and M&A to expand its portfolio. Take a listen. So I'm really interested in digging into how this business combination came together and why the time was right for ABPRO to make this step. But it almost feels like a better starting point is how ABPRO progressed its clinical program to where it was able to establish this major partnership with Celltrion. Can you explain a bit how that came together, Ian?
Yeah. So we started the company as a next generation antibody company. So creating antibodies against traditionally difficult targets. And we're very successful early on with almost 300 campaigns against some of the most difficult targets in the pharmaceutical and biotech industry with some of the leading players. And then it was a natural evolution to move downstream from a platform company into a therapeutics company focused on treating severe disease. So the bulk of the pipeline was in immuno-oncology. So that's where we started out, I would say 5 to 6 years ago. And then our team has been steadily working on that, as well as other antibodies and indications like eye care and also infectious disease. But immuno-oncology has been the bread and butter of the company. And we found a way to really engage the natural immune system to target disease tissue with novel molecules called bispecific antibodies. So this is stimulating the human immune system to be able to go after very targeted tumor molecules. And we steadily built out capabilities there, which we consider to be on the forefront of next generation antibodies. So our lead molecule, which is ABP-102, we've been able to create a much wider therapeutic window for that, meaning more efficacy and more safety compared to current modalities of treatment. And that's what attracted Celltrion to really partner with us. So they took a look at it, obviously did extensive diligence, and then concluded that this was a molecule that could be advanced into the clinic and beyond to treat breast cancer and also gastric cancer. So, and the partnership's been great because we're bringing different things to the table. So they are bringing financial resources. A partnership is fully funded by them. And then we're bringing the scientific expertise and the molecule as well. So that became a very logical way to really get the partnership going. And it's been going great so far.
And Shahrab, you know, from the SPAC standpoint, I'm interested in how important some of those relationships were in terms of your calculations in this search, because there don't really appear to be a ton of biotech targets at this stage that have de-risked their next few steps quite like ABPRO has.
Yeah, I think that was a huge part of our decision-making, right? So if you look at a traditional biotech company, it obviously needs to go through some very large financing rounds. The fact that Ian and his team created this JV with Celltrion that creates a fully financed program on one side, and then a number of other targets that have yet to be financed, but we have a clear pathway to financing them, I think that was huge, right? And they also have a very large shareholder who's been very supportive, both in a strategic sense and in a financing sense. So I think it's rare that you get a target that's de-risked, both in terms of, I guess, their scientific outcomes as well as the financing pathways they need to take. So, you know, for us, obviously going public is a huge undertaking for a company. You know, I think a lot of internal resources need to get diverted, and it obviously needs to make sense for the company. And so the fact that all the stakeholders at ABPRO were committed to going public and understood the benefits of going public for their path, but that path was significantly de-risked for us, obviously was hugely important.
Moving from that into that path to getting these candidates into, you know, through the clinical process and becoming treatments, can you just walk us through a bit what your pipeline is going to look like for the next 2 to 3 years and getting those through that path?
Yeah. So we have two molecules that are ready for the clinic in the near term, 12 to 18 months. So that would be ABP-102. That's the one with Celltrion. So that's in very late stage IND enabling studies. So that'll be, we expect in phase one very shortly. And then ABP-201 is our bispecific for eye care, wet AMD and DME. So those are two biggest indications in eye care. So companies like Regeneron were built around those indications. And then Roche has also proved our thesis for creating a bispecific in eye care. They got a recent approval for their product called Vabysmo, which is for wet AMD. And we have a similar mechanism of action. In fact, a lot of companies were quite skeptical of this approach many years ago. So we were one of the companies that bet on that. And it's really worked out in our minds since Vabysmo got approved. So this is a multi-billion dollar indication. So that one we expect will be in a clinic next year and then progressing through phase one. And then right behind that are additional programs as well. So we have our Claudin 18.2 ABP-150 program. That's for non-HER2 positive gastric cancer. And then we have a liver cancer program as well. So those are ready for the clinic within that timeframe, the 2 to 3 year timeframe.
Great. And I wanted to get into ADPRO's diverse immune and multimab platforms as well. As you mentioned, you know, diverse immune has been involved in over 300 discovery campaigns to date. And so just how does that work and how has the platform evolved through that work?
Yeah. So when we started, we were looking for a way to increase the cycle time at which antibodies could be generated. Because when we launched, the average time frame was 2 years to create an antibody. So we found ways through technology, and we developed those in-house, reduced that time frame to 2 months. So we launched initially as a platform company. We validated against all sorts of different targets. We really built it up over time. And that's been the mainstay of our platform in the sense that we can create these building blocks that can either be used as monoclonal antibody therapies, which is the largest class of therapies in biotech today, and also bispecific antibodies. So these are two-pronged antibodies. They can grab cancer cells and we can bring immune cells directly to the cancer cells. So the front end is really where a lot of the activity takes place to create future generations of new products and therapies. So we can continually add to the pipeline that way. And then there's a engineering component at the end. And then we have the ability to move it into the clinic.
What it leads right into is a multimab where you're able to, you know, kind of continue to tailor those antibodies. I'm interested in, you know, do you view that as being a platform and a tool that helps you, you know, just continually find more potential candidates and more potential, you know, kind of forks in the road, other things to explore? Have you been finding it most useful to tailor and really kind of shrink down and be more precise with what you're already working with?
It's really the ability to take these building blocks and then fine-tune them for whatever indication they need to be. So for eye care, there's specific engineering features the molecule needs to have. And then oncology, same thing. So each target can be different, but that's where the platform really excels. We have the ability to really create antibodies that are fit for purpose against whatever target they're going after. And to do it in a very quick time frame as well.
Great. And then just, you know, looking at the market a bit for ABP-102 and ABP-201, your materials, you have quite a bit of information in there about, the, you know, what you expect the potential market to be and how you expect revenues to progress through the life of those candidates should they pass all the way through the process. How did you go about calculating that treatment market? And you've mentioned a few of the other companies that have been working in this area. Can you tell us a bit about, you know, some of those competing potential treatments?
Those numbers came from a highly respected consulting company called Health Advances. So, and the indications that we're going after are well known out there. Wet AMD, DME, indication for eye care. So those numbers are quite established. Same with the HER2 market, HER2 positive. That's Herceptin. So that's been on the market for quite a bit of time. So those numbers are all out there. So we have a strategy that really improves on the first generation versions of those molecules. And that's how we know that's going to be patient need. So we're not going after indications that are not yet established. And the companies that are playing there, are, you know, they've really grown with these indications. Like Regeneron is certainly one of them. It's built on wet AMD, DME, Eylea, and then Roche as well, through initially Lucentis and then now Vabysmo. So it was Genentech before.
Great. And then moving to the other two candidates you mentioned there, the ABP 150 and 110, they're a bit further off in development, but you've already secured some strategic collaboration for those candidates as well. Can you just run us through again more of how that relationship with Nanjing and how that their pathway should progress as well?
Yeah, so we were looking for a partner early on in the life cycle. So we partnered with like China rights, and then we kept European and also US rights. They provided some of the initial R&D funding. I mean, we're eligible for milestones downstream up to $400 million. And so that's really what helped get the program off to a start. So that one is quite close to the clinic as well. So that would be the next molecule I would go in. And then ABP-110 is the one for liver cancer. That one we partnered with the NIH. So there was a KOL over there in the space for GPC3. That's the target. It's quite an exciting target. So we partnered with them to really take that to generate a bispecific antibody around that. So for a new indication.
Great. And, you know, with those partnerships in hand, what are ABPRO's capital needs like through these next few years as you're commercializing these candidates? And how do you plan to use the proceeds from this transaction?
So the great thing is ABP-102 is fully funded. As far as development costs, manufacturing, that's all taken care of. We're going to be providing funding for the internal team to really support it. So I think that will be, well, that's really the main requirement there. And then the rest of the capital goes to the other programs. So 201 would be the next program, which we want to move into the clinic next year. And then 150 right behind that. And the capital needs are in the $50 to $75 million range over the next 2 years. And then that'll allow us to have two and potentially a third program into the clinic very shortly thereafter.
And as we've been discussing where all these things sit and where you are in the progression for all of them, why did you decide that now was the right time for ABPRO to go public and why through a SPAC?
Really driven by the progression of the company. So in the beginning, there's a lot of scientific risk, I would say, for any new company. So you're trying to get your technology like working. So we actually did all that. And then companies are actually trying to work out the biology. All this takes years usually. And then sometimes a lead molecule works or it doesn't. So some companies have to go back to the drawing board. So that this is a multi-year cycle. Eventually you get close enough to the clinic where everything is just about financing the programs. So the bottom that becomes really development stage oriented. So that's capital. So that's where the company's at. And as far as like why right now, we feel like we can create a lot of value this time. I know certain parts of the biotech markets are still depressed, but we see opening right now. And we always believe that good companies with great science will always get funded. So that's been our view.
And also just to add to that, where by design or by luck, Ian's team has probably timed things pretty well in the sense that all these deals take time. And by the time you get public, you know, you're trying to hit a target 6 to 9 months out. All the indications for the public market look really good right now in terms of what you're seeing in IPOs, what you're seeing in terms of funding, even the private market. So from that perspective, I also think it's a really great time to be a public company.
Yeah, and kind of with that in mind, it looks like you guys are continuing the conversations and the process of raising a pipe. We know that it's been a very tight market for the last couple of years, really, in terms of pulling pipes together. How has that process been like, and how have your conversations been going so far?
I would say we've been getting quite a number of inbound inquiries, so that's a good sign. So it's a matter of a process right now, and then bringing in the right investors and getting the pipeline.
And to add to that, you know, our strategy has been basically, obviously, ABPRO's built quite a following over time. So there's a decent amount of incoming, as Ian talked about, you know, from the investors that are already in the company, as well as investors that know the company well. So our goal is to basically build an anchor in the pipe around those investors, and then go more towards traditional biotech fundamental investors, et cetera. But, you know, really people that understand the science, understand the company, and build around people that understand the trajectory of the company.
And I mean, as you know, Sharab, the the kind of the de-SPACing process has these particular moments where, you know, sometimes the options change a little bit closer to close, or sometimes, and they change again once the deal has closed and the company is public again. Just sort of philosophically, what's, you know, what's been your approach like in terms of, you know, balancing? Because sometimes investors do see it as, you know, balancing the interests of, you know, the original SPAC investors versus, you know, incoming PIPE investors, but then there's also different options on the other end of close. Just sort of, you know, what are been the conversations like, and what's the, how would you sum up your strategy in terms of pulling all those elements together?
Yeah, so if I can just take a step back in terms of how we approach this. On the surface, we look like a SPAC that was originally formed around mobility to, so then to merge with a biotech target, you know, on the outside feels kind of strange. But if you look underneath the hood, one of our main investors in the SPAC is a company called Apeiron. They've had 4 IPOs in the last few years. In fact, they just took Alto Neurotech public a couple of days ago. You know, that stock's done really well. So they're a very, very experienced biotech investor. One of our board members and management team members is a partner at a biotech VC fund, as well as very close to one of the larger universities' medical schools. So our ability to understand biotech, diligence biotech, understand kind of both the science, but also the investor reaction to the science, I think is quite good. Otherwise, you know, we would not have progressed with this deal because we simply wouldn't have been able to do the diligence that we needed to. From that perspective, I feel very comfortable in terms of the work that we've done. Now, obviously, as you mentioned, market conditions change all the time. That's totally outside our control. But I also think that one of the good things about APRO is that their capital needs are somewhat within their control/discretion. So if market environment gets really hard, I think we have some ability to dial down spending and vice versa. So that does give us a lot of leeway while in the meantime having a core asset that is independently financed. So the company is kind of de-risked through having risk in various buckets rather than having all its risk in one bucket.
Yeah, and you touched upon what I wanted to get to in my next question, actually, is, you know, because, you know, there was some initial indications that Atlantic Coastal 2, you know, wanted to look at mobility. And obviously, we've seen a lot of deals being done in that space over the last couple of years. But, you know, so what were some of the, I guess, some of the macro factors you saw out there in terms of how the market was reacting to deals and sort of what the different opportunities were from business to business and from sector to sector as you were going through this process?
Yeah, so essentially the biggest problem in the mobility space is that the CapEx is typically very bulky and not discretionary. So I'll give you an example. There's a company we're looking at. They had a revolutionary technology, let's call it in the wheel/tire space. The technology was phenomenal. Every expert we talked to loved it. They had great contracts, but they needed $200 million to build a factory, right? And it wasn't maybe 50, maybe 100, maybe 300. It was 200, that number or nothing. So at that point, if you go through the capital raising process and you haven't raised the 200, you know, you kind of have a very binary decision. And so you're really beholden to hitting a certain number. And a lot of the mobility targets that we looked at very much had that profile. So at that point, we had to start looking at other spaces where the CapEx slash the, you know, the R&D runway was slightly more discretionary and slightly less bulky. And so that was definitely part of our decision making.
Yeah, and even in looking, you know, beyond this, you know, once ABPRO is public and has access to public capital of different forms, and given that it has sort of operated as a platform company before, do you see there being some opportunities to make acquisitions as a company that's public moving forward, or do you think the company is best served letting Diversimmune and Multimab continue to be sort of origination engines for its candidates?
Yeah, I mean, I think our goal is to build the leading platform in this space. So there could be acquisitions of technology, acquisitions of companies, certainly organic growth, which has been our bread and butter. Building on that, we see many possibilities to really take this.
I think, Nick, one other point in terms of what attracted us to APRO is that if you look at the scientific advisory board, I mean, it's literally the who's who of that space. Because often when you have these SPAC companies that come out, they have experienced leaders, but there's not a lot of depth. And I think with APRO, there's a massive depth there.
Yeah, I can quickly go through who's involved. So Bob Langer, co-founder of Moderna. So he's someone we've known since many years ago. And he joined APRO almost from day one. So he's on our board and also scientific advisory board. On the oncology side, Ron Levy, he started IDEC, which became Biogen IDEC. He discovered CD20, rituximab. Laurie Klimcher, she runs Dana-Farber. So that's one of the largest cancer institutes. She's on a board of some really large companies like GSK. And then Steve Schnittman on the infectious disease side, he ran the HIV division at NIAID. So he's an expert there. Excellent. Shiv Pillai at Harvard Medical School. So he's really autoimmune and also antibody expert. So those are folks that we interact with on a very, very regular basis, especially certainly on the science side. And then also on the autoimmunity side, George Sokas. So he's a autoimmune expert who we get advice from on the autoimmune side.
Great. And in terms of the technology that you've been touching upon and utilizing in different ways using your platform, what do you see as some of the most exciting things in the treatment areas that you've been involved in that maybe we haven't touched upon yet?
Yeah, we see that we're still at the tip of the iceberg in general for modern medicine. So that by that, we see a lot of, we're still stuck with a lot of modalities that are from many years ago for treatment of, for example, oncology, like surgery, radiation, chemotherapy. A lot of the newer therapies like bispecific antibodies are a lot more targeted. So, and there are so many exciting new targets out there around the biology and the understanding of biology as well. So we see almost an unlimited number of targets. And as you add all the targets with all the new technologies that are available, AI is going to play a big role as well. The speed of discovery is just going to dramatically keep on accelerating over the next years. So that's going to create a lot of opportunity to treat patients with new therapies that can make a really big difference in oncology and also other areas. And antibodies cover certainly oncology, autoimmunity, eye care, infectious disease as well. So there are many categories to take this. So it's about having a platform that can really be nimble, effective, and then create the largest therapeutic window possible.
And definitely, I'm just interested as you've been going through conversations with investors, just because we've been able to see that across all sectors, the market has been very hungry for candidates that can demonstrate their self-sustainability in terms of their financial situation and whatnot, given the macro conditions. But obviously, drug discovery is a process that takes a little time to get to those big revenue milestones and whatnot. Although you've already done a lot of the legwork in terms of having these partners that are going to support you through a lot of that process. I'm just curious what have been some of the kind of the big questions and some of the big points you've been driving home when speaking with investors as you're going through this process.
I think it's the ability to be able to attract partners like Celltrion that can really fund entire programs. And we have a 50% profit share at the back end as well. So not only is it fully funded, it's not like the deal where we have single digit royalties. The upside is 50% worldwide. So that can provide at the finish line of getting an approval, cash flows into the company. And then that can be reinvested into the business through the discovery engine to create more programs on a non-dilutive basis. So we see that as a very viable model. And the key is to be able to demonstrate the molecule is effective enough to future potential partners and to form business development partnerships that make sense from a financial perspective to create a lot of equity value. Because in biotech, the dilution is usually one of the big killers of equity value. So if a company needs to, say, raise $300 million for phase three, it's going to be challenging for a lot of companies. Not only that, but potentially very risky.
And so just given how much has been de-risked and how much you guys have worked to create some visibility on what the potential revenues are like moving forward here, I'm interested, Shirab, just how do you approach that valuation process, adjusting for risk, and discounting for the fact that some of these revenues are going to be coming in, at some point, a few years down the road?
Yeah, so to a certain extent, it's a little bit of not a science project, but an art project, right? And obviously, there's a lot of moving parts, but we certainly ascribed a lot of value to the Celltrion partnership because that provides kind of like a valuation baseline. When we did the independent valuation through Health Advances, they came back on just the main two compounds at a $1.2 billion NPV. And obviously, that's an NPV and not a gross number. So, we use those kind of factors to sort of triangulate around the valuation number. One thing I'm absolutely certain of, and I'm sure everybody will know, that once we de-SPAC, there will be a lot of volatility. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of moving parts. But at the end of the day, once everything settles down, I think the true value of the company will come out. And I'm very confident that the valuation that we've set now will end up looking good for investors.